You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Tim McMaster, going around the American League East as the hot stove season heats up. The Yankees and Rays have already made November trades. David Ortiz will step away from the game after the 2016 season, and the Blue Jays look to take the first steps towards defending their division title. That's where we start with MLB.com Jays reporter Gregor Chisholm. Blue Jays wasting no time getting busy, and Gregor, the first order of business was picking up the options on Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, and R.A. Dickey. No-brainers, but important nonetheless, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, what that kind of shows is this offseason, at least from an offensive standpoint, the Blue Jays really have all the pieces in place already. I mean, this is a team that is potentially returning all nine starting position players from the 2015 division championship team. And obviously the main strength of that team from this past season was the lineup. And this is a team that should continue to hit. It should continue to be a strength and the ability to lock up guys like Encarnacion and Bautista to keep this window of opportunity moving forward for at least another year. This is a team now that can kind of, go ahead with what they already have offensively and continue to look on the pitching staff is where they need help the most.
Some bad news on Wednesday for the club. Devin Travis, he's going to miss 4 to 5 months after shoulder surgery. It's a shoulder that bothered him during the season. He missed the last couple months of the regular season. The Jays kind of know what they're going to miss from this guy because he was so good early on in 2015. What do they do to kind of fill that space? Do they have the guys? Can Goins kind of step in there and continue to fill the hole? Or do you see a situation where this team maybe goes out there and makes a move?
Yeah, no, I think for the most part they can stick with the status quo. I mean, we saw Ryan Goins fill in during the second half of the year after the trade deadline when Travis originally got hurt, and Goins really played the best baseball of his entire career. Now, there's some question marks about whether or not he'll be able to continue with that upside, especially with some of the plate discipline he was showing, a high number of walks in the second half. That might be tough for him to maintain, but I think there's a comfort level there from the Blue Jays' perspective that they have the depth required to take over for Travis during his absence. And I think more than anything else, this is a team that's probably going to look to add at the backup position. You're probably going to see a couple of guys added on minor league deals before this offseason is done. Probably a few more veteran types who are going to come in and compete for that role and also provide some depth at AAA. But it's really just more that overall depth that they need to add as opposed to that starter, because they can move forward with Goins until Travis is ready to go. But there's no question mark that the Travis having that delayed to the start of 2016 and now having his start of the season put into jeopardy is still a big blow to this team.
I guess the other question is, if we start the 2016 season and Ryan Goins is as good as he was late in 2015, will Travis kind of have to come in and win his job back?
Yeah, it's certainly possible, and that was already kind of one of the question marks about this offseason originally. It was whether or not the Blue Jays could look to trade either Goins or Travis, and obviously that kind of question has been answered based on by default on the injury to Travis. I mean, either one isn't going to get dealt anytime soon, but Travis might need to prove himself a little bit. And I think the Jays have the luxury here of being able to take their time with Travis and make sure that he properly rehabs. And even if that means his start next year doesn't happen until the middle of May or even into June, that's something the Blue Jays might be able to stomach because of some of the replacements, but they're gonna make sure that he forces his way back up. But the plan all along this offseason, even though Goins took over in the second half of 2015, was that job was still belonged to Devin Travis. So at some point, I do expect him to regain that role. He's just not going to be pressed into it earlier than needed.
Marco Estrada is staying put in Toronto. We knew coming into the offseason the Blue Jays had to bring back or sign more starting pitching with so many guys leaving the team. So Estrada, when you look at a two-year deal that came together so quickly, says a lot about the fact that he really wanted to stay in Toronto.
Yeah, he really did. And I think this was almost a foregone conclusion from when the end of the season happened, especially when the Blue Jays made him a qualifying offer. I think Estrada was going to be, have a little bit of difficulty, with being able to find a multi-year deal when teams were going to have to part with a first-round draft pick as well. So I think that limited his market a little bit. But, you know, he's been saying the right things all along. And, you know, why wouldn't he want to come back after the year that he was a part of here? You know, really earned everything he got this season, starting the year, you know, out of the bullpen and not moving into the rotation until May. I mean, he exceeded everybody's expectations. So, you know, I think there's also some comfort level from the Jays standpoint as well. I mean, this isn't a guy they needed to go out and sign to a 4 or 5 year deal. He's getting a very high annual salary over the next two seasons, but long term, that still gives the Blue Jays some flexibility as well. And they really needed to get him back into the fold because there was just too many holes in that starting rotation. Even with him back, they still need to address that, but the concern isn't quite as pressing as it was, you know, a week ago before Estrada came to terms.
Yeah, let's talk about the rest of that rotation and what needs to be done. And I think you got to start with David Price, finished second for the Cy Young Award, finishing the season, obviously, with the Blue Jays. The market for him is probably going to take a little while to build before it becomes clear, but is there still a hope in Toronto that he could be back in a Blue Jays uniform?
A little bit. I think for the most part, though, I think expectations are pretty tapered, even from the fan base. You know, I think that most people assume that he's not going to return. I think the Blue Jays are still kind of keeping a slightly open mind on that. But I think, you know, just in terms of the years and overall numbers that Price is going to be able to get, and you know, the big market teams that are, you know, interested in his services, like the Cubs, I mean, that's going to make it very, very challenging for the Jays. I don't have much doubt that they're going to try very aggressively to do something through free agency. I don't think it's going to be Price in the end. I think it might be the guys who are a little bit of a notch below that, whether it's guys like Jordan Zimmerman. You know, Doug Fister had been a guy who was very appealing to Alex Anthopoulos in the past. And I think one of the interesting things over the next few weeks is going to be to see how many of those guys the Blue Jays still go after that were tied to Anthopoulos, even though, you know, LaCava is the new man in charge for right now with the Blue Jays. He's a guy who's an assistant to Anthopoulos as well. And some of the names the Jays were linked to before could still be some of the guys that they eventually go and target. But they need at least one guy. And it's an argument could be made that they would look even more better with a couple of more arms to that rotation.
Brian, the hot stove is heating up, and the Yankees wasted no time. A couple of trades really right out of the chute. So let's start with that, kind of catch people up on the trades and what it means for this Yankees team as we head forward towards the 2016 season. I think obviously the more interesting trade, they acquire Aaron Hicks for John Ryan Murphy. So basically trading from a place of strength where they have another catcher on the way up in Gary Sanchez. And they get Aaron Hicks, who really an intriguing player, I think. He can already do it defensively. We'll see about the offense. But where do you think Aaron Hicks fits into this Yankees team?
Yeah, I think this is a lot of what Brian Cashman is trying to do. You see how they're committed financially around the board to a lot of different guys, and it doesn't look like they're going to be major players on the free agent market. So what they're doing is being creative on the trade front. And Hicks is the latest example of that. He could serve a lot of different roles. I think right now on paper, you look at him as the replacement for Chris Young. He's a switch hitter. He can hit left-handed pitching. He can fill that role pretty well, but Cashman said the Yankees see Hicks as an everyday player, and he might get that opportunity. It allows them to move Brett Gardner, and they can at least dangle him out there and see what he could bring back in trade. It should be a substantial return if they decide to move him. You could have Aaron Hicks. He would be your fourth outfielder, or he would be in starting in left field, and then you'd have Jacoby Ellsbury in center and Carlos Beltran in right. So basically this move gives the Yankees a lot of flexibility, and that's what Brian Cashman's trying to do.
You mentioned possibly trading Gardner, and obviously there's plenty of rumors out there about that. Two questions on Gardner, I guess. One, what would they be looking to get in return? And the other question, I think, is it almost better to hang on to him just because you mentioned Carlos Beltran and Wright? We know how old Carlos Beltran is, and he's been injured at times. Is it almost safer to have that net in case Beltran would get hurt at some point?
Yeah, I think, well, when you're looking, Carlos Beltran, he's 38 and is in the final year of a deal. There's always a concern about that. I think that's what you go in with a lot of these aging veteran guys, with Mark Teixeira, with Alex Rodriguez. If healthy, they should be productive, but that's always a big if. So I think there's no urgency to move Gardner. The reason that he's so valuable – And the reason that teams are interested is because he's one of the few veterans on this team with actual trade value who could bring back a significant return. So I think you look at that and you say, is there a second baseman out there, for example? Or is there a starting pitcher out there that could be brought back for Brett Gardner? And if that's the case, yes. But I, from what I've been told, the Yankees would be perfectly okay if opening day was tomorrow and they had to put Brett Gardner in a lineup in left field. They'd be perfectly fine with that. So I think it's just a situation where they know they're not going to be in on the guys, the big-ticket guys, Zach Greinke, the Johnny Cueto's, the David Price's. It just doesn't look like one of those off-seasons where the Yankees are going to spend it and put out a nine-figure commitment, say a Jordan Zimmerman, any of those starting pitchers. But if there's something out there that you can dangle Brett Gardner and a team says, you know, we could put Brett Gardner in center field every day at the top of the lineup, and that would be a good investment, then maybe that's what you do with him. But as of right now, the Yankees would be just fine if it went the other way and he was in the lineup on opening day.
And what does this mean for Gary Sanchez, this trade? He's their number five prospect. He's really shown what he can do at the minor league level. Is this the year that he could end up being that backup catcher to Brian McCann, or would they like him to get more at-bats in the minors?
I think it very well could happen. I think that they wouldn't have made this move if Sanchez didn't look ready, if he wasn't tearing up the Arizona Fall League. John Ryan Murphy was a solid, dependable, you knew he could handle the job of backing up Brian McCann. I mean, the Twins think he's going to be their starting catcher next year. He's certainly going to get a shot. So you could have kept Murphy, but Sanchez looks like he's coming into his own. He's developed a lot maturity-wise. Could he develop more if he had an everyday job catching at AAA? Yeah, he might. But, you know, Cashman was saying this last week. The Yankees have done this before. They did it with guys like Jorge Posada, with Francisco Cervelli, just to name two. These are guys who started out as backup catchers and became legitimate everyday catchers in the big leagues. And so maybe that's what you do with Gary Sanchez. You can still learn a lot and develop a lot, even if you're only catching 1 or 2 days a week in the big leagues compared to being back there every day at AAA.
The other trade the Yankees have made, they send Jose Perella to the Padres. They get Ronald Herrera back. Herrera, just 20 years old, but it seems like this move was more about just clearing up roster space, correct? Herrera's 20, and obviously there's some upside there, but he doesn't exactly fit into the Yankees' top prospects.
No, he doesn't. And it's you get a live arm, and he's 20 years old, and he's probably going to be down in Class A Tampa and maybe Double A Trenton, but I think that would be a stretch next year. Now, this is a paperwork move. Perella was a nice player. They appreciated his contributions, but he looked like he was back on that depth chart. I mean, going into spring training at second base, you're looking at Dustin Ackley and Rob Refsnyder as the tandem, and they're going to try and improve upon that, and Perella was a distant third behind those guys. So it was a situation where he gets a new opportunity. He can go to the Padres and compete for a roster spot. And the Yankees get a little more flexibility. Look, they've got to protect some guys for this Rule 5 draft coming up at the winter meetings. So Perella, in their eyes, they like him, but not enough to keep a roster spot there. So they wish him the best and send him packing.
All right, let's talk second base, Brian, because that was a big glaring hole for this team throughout the 2015 season, at least on the offensive side of things. They got a little lift from Dustin Ackley late in the year after trading for him, but it seemed like heading into this offseason, Ben Zobrist just seemed like a perfect fit for this team with his ability to play in different places, a solid defender, a guy that can hit, but now it sounds like the Yankees aren't really looking at Zobrist. What are you hearing as far as what they're going to do at second base, and is there a chance Zobrist comes back into play at some point this offseason?
I think there's always a chance, and I wouldn't be shocked if the Yankees have done this before where they sit out the first round, so to speak, of the hot stove, and then they jump in at the end. Zobrist just makes a lot of sense for them. The one thing that the Yankees want is they want a player who's confident on offense and defense. They look at Ackley and Refsnyder, and they think both those guys can hit, especially if they platoon them righty-lefty, that kind of thing. They could probably be serviceable, but you saw how reluctant they were to put Refsnyder in the field at the end of last year. They were just really nervous about the defense, and he's a converted outfielder who's been learning the position. Ackley, obviously the bat is better than the glove at this point. That's a situation where if they can improve and get a guy who can help on both sides of the ball, they want to do it. They probably should do it. I think that Ben Zobrist just makes a lot of sense for the Yankees. But as of right now, they're going to sit out the first couple rounds. But like I said, stay tuned. We've seen this before.
You mentioned that you don't expect the Yankees to be involved in a nine-figure contract or those big free agents out there. And Hal Steinbrenner has kind of talked about not wanting to go out and spend the big money. And he doesn't, I think his quote was, he doesn't think you need a $200 million payroll to win a championship, which has obviously been proven many times to be correct. So you look at last year when really Andrew Miller was the only big contract they brought in. And now this year, just talk about this new philosophy for the Yankees, and it's kind of interesting to see. And I think it changes these hot stove seasons for the entire sport, just not having the Yankees as a factor on every free agent available.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a ripple effect there. And don't forget, last year they brought in Chase Headley and spent pretty big on him too. But I your overall point, austerity is the way that the Yankees want to go. Look, you heard Hal Steinbrenner talk about this $189 million and wanting to be on the luxury tax so many times. It hasn't happened yet. It may not happen at all. There was so much talk about they weren't going to spend, and then they went out and said, all right, we're going to take Masahiro Tanaka, and we'll take Jacoby Ellsbury, and we'll sign Carlos Beltran, too. And so you just never know. The Yankees are kind of like the one, the grandma who walks around the mall and then refuses to buy anything and then just says, oh, okay, here's the big screen TV, take it. So as now that we're getting into holiday shopping season, it remains to be seen if the Yankees really will hold to that. I think that at the end of the day, sure, would they like to get younger and more flexible? Of course. And you had a lot of encouraging signs. You had guys like Greg Bird and Luis Severino, and you have Aaron Judge knocking on the door and Gary Sanchez as well. And they're talking about James Kaprielian, their first pick from last year. He may be in the big leagues by the end of the year. Jacob Lindgren. There's a lot of young talent to be excited about coming up through the Yankee farm system. But I don't think you're ever going to see a day where the Yankees field a team that was completely built only from within. Even when they had the Jeters and Posadas and the Andy Pettis and the Mariano Riveras coming up through the system, and everybody wants to talk about the core, look, there were the veteran guys there. There were the Paul O'Neills who made that all come together and really were the veteran talents there. So it's got to be a blend. The Yankees are still the Yankees. They're still going to spend money. They're still going to have a high payroll. Does it have to be a $250 million payroll? No, I don't think it does. But I think it's going to be significant. I don't think you're going to see a day where the Yankees are crying poverty. I think that they're always going to be players to spend money. And no matter what they say, at the end of the day, I think actions speak louder than words.
The hot stove season is here. Dave Dombrowski hasn't wasted any time getting busy, Ian, but let's start with the biggest story around Boston and with the Red Sox, David Ortiz announcing that he will call it a career at the end of the 2016 season. And maybe the most interesting thing about this decision is the way it came about when he makes the announcement via the Players Tribune, Derek Jeter's website. Were you surprised about the way this all came about and how David chose to make the announcement?
No, I wasn't terribly surprised the way it came out, just because, look, David wrote a lengthy piece for the Players Tribune back in March about he wanted to get the record straight about performance-enhancing drugs and how he thought he was sort of given a raw deal in that whole thing, and, you know, he kind of explained his side of the story. So he's obviously comfortable in this forum, and I just think it's becoming more commonplace for athletes today to sort of, they want to get the stories out on their terms. And, you know, this was something that David wanted to put out on his 40th birthday, that he plans on retiring after the 2016 season. I think the bigger surprise here in Red Sox land was just that he's already made this decision that he doesn't want to play, you know, after 2016. Because usually when a guy like David Ortiz has a year like he has in 2015, where he had 37 homers and 108 RBIs, you say, okay, I'm going to see how long I can keep playing like this, you know. And so I think it was eye-opening to people that they thought, you know, maybe David's losing some of that edge to play the game of baseball. And maybe, like he said, he's, you know, itching to get to that next chapter. He said life is about chapters, and, you know, he's ready to do the next one. And maybe some of it's because, look, he's already won three championships. He hit his 500th home run. He's done just about everything you could accomplish on a personal level or a team level. So really, what more is there for him to do? And I think it says something about David that, look, David wants to go out while he's still a feared slugger. He doesn't want to be one of these guys that hangs on a year or two too long. So, you know, I think it's good that David has made this decision and can just sort of soak in this final year.
I know he's talked a lot about how it gets harder and harder for him every year to get ready with his age, obviously, getting up there. And now that he's a month into the offseason, I wonder if that had something to do with it. But one thing I think we're going to get from this is maybe not on the grand scale of Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera, but in some way there's going to be a farewell tour. And I know in the past he said he didn't want that, but you got to believe he's going to get it, right?
Yeah, you would have to think that David Ortiz is going to get recognized by a lot of teams. Now, is it going to be every single team like it was with Jeter or Mariano Rivera? Not quite sure yet that it's going to be at that level. And I don't think David demands it at that level either. I think, you know, maybe when we get late in the season and they're playing teams, you know, in the AL East or teams that he has a certain history with or whatever, maybe you'll see something there. So we're just going to have to kind of see you know, how it shakes out and what, you know, I think David will help drive the bus a little bit here too. But certainly I think a lot of people already have October 3rd, 2016, or October 2nd, I should say, circled on their calendar for David Ortiz's last regular season game with the Red Sox at Fenway Park against the Toronto Blue Jays. I think that's going to be a tough ticket to get in the city of Boston. It's going to be an emotional day. We've seen some great goodbyes over the years. People still talk about Carly Yastrzemski's farewell weekend in 1983, and I think David's kind of on the same level as what he's meant to the Red Sox.
Yeah, that Yastrzemski weekend, I actually remember that being one of kind of my first baseball memories, not to age myself or anything, but all right, let's look at Ortiz. One last question about Poppy and the career he's had with the Red Sox, all the All-Star games, the three World Series titles that you mentioned. Where does he fit as far as all-time Red Sox?
Yeah, and I think you still have to put Ted Williams as the all-time greatest Red Sox. When you look at, like, the guy hit 400. He won triple crowns, just a larger-than-life guy. You know, it was a different playoff system back then. You know, Ted might have been in some more postseasons if, you know, there was a wild card like there is in today's day and age. So even though he doesn't have the championships, I still think you have to put him as the greatest Red Sox of all time. I think right now you'd probably put David Ortiz number two when you look at the whole body of work and what this guy did in October, what he did during the season to really lead the way for three different world championship teams, the first three the Red Sox have had since 1918, and just what he's meant to the city from a community standpoint, the kind of teammate he's been, and just the production year in and year out. I would say Ted Williams first, and then David Ortiz.
It's certainly going to be a fun year with David Ortiz going out, and hopefully for Red Sox fans, they hope he can go out on top of the game. But let's move on to the hot stove season now. And David Dombrowski, as we said in the intro, wasted no time starting to put this 2016 roster together. He trades four prospects to the San Diego Padres, and they get Craig Kimbrel. And when you're talking about closers in baseball, other than Aroldis Chapman, maybe a little bit better, Craig Kimbrel is right there as one of the top arms in the ninth inning.
Yeah, you know, I was actually talking to an old friend of mine that I used to cover, Kurt Schilling, yesterday on the phone, and, you know, he was saying that, you know, yeah, he thinks that Kimbrel is the second-best closer in baseball, really, and after Chapman, and he said that, look, the guy has perfect mechanics. He reminded Schilling of John Smoltz back when he was closing, and, you know, a little bit of Papelbon when Papelbon was really at the top of his game in Boston. So, yeah, look, I think Craig Kimbrel is going to come in and make a huge impact on this Red Sox team. I think the adrenaline of pitching in Boston is really going to take his game, maybe even to a level it hasn't been yet. And, you know, they gave up four prospects, but you know, I think that a lot of Red Sox fans will take that deal and they'll like what Dombrowski did to really upgrade this team.
Bill, the hot stove season is here, but let's start by just quickly looking back at 2015. We've had some time now to digest the Rays of 2015. They end up winning 80 games in a good division. It's a season in which you have to be able to, you take a lot of positives from it, don't you?
Yeah, you know, at the end of the season, I sat there and said, gee, you think this team won 80 games. And, you know, based on all of the, you know, pratfalls they had during the year, you know, I mean, you got your number one pitcher goes down, countless injuries, and then somehow at the end of the year you end up with 80 wins. I think there's a lot to be optimistic about.
They didn't waste any time getting busy this hot stove season as well. Already with a trade, they get Brad Miller, Logan Morrison, Danny Farquhar from the Mariners. They give up Nathan Karns Boog Powell and C.J. Riefenhauser. Now, I think Miller's a very interesting piece of this trade. Seems like the type of player that the Rays really, really like.
Yeah, he looks like he's somebody they can keep for a while and can, you know, they can kind of build stuff on. He's an offensive guy and supposedly a sure-handed guy at shortstop. I have heard that they want to, you know, work a little bit on his consistency on some of the plays, but I think it was a move for a need they have, and I think they, you know, went out pretty quick and got it done. So I like the way they kind of went out and struck first.
Now, Logan Morrison's an interesting guy. When he first came up, I remember with the Marlins, a somewhat touted prospect. He's been up and down in his career. What do you think the Rays like about him that they made him a part of this deal?
Well, they're looking for any kind of extra offense, and he can, you know, he's been known to hit for pretty good power. I know when we were talking to him on the conference call after he got traded to the Rays, he was saying, he hopes he's not just pigeonholed against right-handers only. You know, he said he did not hit well against left-handers this year, but he has hit well against left-handers in the past. And, you know, he sounds like it's going to be kind of a mission for him to prove again that he can be on the field against both, you know, sides of the plate.
Obviously, you have to give up something to get something, and Nathan Carnes goes the other way. But it's trading from a place of strength for the Rays. All the starting pitching they have, did that make it okay to give up a guy like Carnes?
Well, I think it did. You know, it was a tough move for them because this year they saw how much strain they could be in if they lost some starting pitching, and they lost some, and so they kind of got down to the fumes. But you know, the way you had Erasmo Ramirez and Carnes came through, you know, it really helped them out this year. But they do, you know, they always feel like they're in a little bit of a precarious position when they're running a little bit thinner on their starting pitching depth.
They still have a good amount of starting pitching. Is there a chance they could move another starter in a deal this offseason, or do you think Carnes is the one guy they were able to let go?
Well, you know, I mean, you have to give up something to get something. And, you know, I think Carnes really pitched well this year. I don't know, you know, if you try and forecast what the Rays are going to do, it drives you crazy. I think anybody is always in play. Having said that, I would probably be surprised if they moved another starting pitcher.
Overall, when you look at this roster heading into this hot stove season, it's interesting, I think, when you look at this Rays team, because there's not a lot of holes to fill. They have the good pitching. They have a good young nucleus. There's not a lot of heavy lifting that has to be done in Tampa Bay this offseason. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's mostly going to be, you know, just kind of decisions need to be made. And I don't know if those decisions will be made during the offseason or if they can hold till spring training. You know, you looked at some of the depth in the outfield. You know, will they rather have more of Brandon Guy, or will they rather have Mikey Mattuck? Will Desmond Jennings come back? You know, you look to the infield. It doesn't look like Cabrera will be back because, you know, he had a really nice season. He's a free agent. He'll probably go out and get a pretty sweet deal outside of the Rays' price range, and the Rays seem to acknowledge that by getting Miller. But then you've got Nick Franklin and Beckham. Which one of those two is going to be the guy? You know, because you've got Logan Forsythe at second base. Catching is the same way. You know, Rivera had a tough year offensively, and then you had Casale came through with the deep power, and Aaron Sepia came up in September and provided some power. So, you know, I think there's some decisions that need to be made in all those things, but I do think that contained within the players they have, they've got some pretty good choices.
Brittany, the hot stove season is upon us, and I think from an Orioles standpoint, things obviously started out with a qualifying offer. They extended three of them with Wei-Yin Chen, Chris Davis, and Matt Wieters, and maybe a surprise that Wieters accepts his. And I think those three decisions are kind of at the heart of everything we're going to talk about today. Let's start with the pitching, though. Wei-Yin Chen's departure, likely departure, leaves a hole in that rotation. And we've heard Dan Duquette say the O's are seeking a top-of-the-rotation starter, but that's probably not one of those top, top-tier guys. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. I think you're looking at maybe that second tier. Guys like Wei-Yin Chen are guys that the Orioles are going to be pursuing. So Jeff Samardzija is a good option for them. Scott Kazmir is a good fit. Even a guy like Ian Kennedy from the Padres, when you look at that favorable strikeout ratio over the past two seasons. So kind of the second tier of available pitchers, I think, is probably more in the Orioles' wheelhouse. They need to upgrade that rotation, but not at the expense of everything else.
Samardzija seems like the perfect kind of Orioles buy in that he's coming off obviously a terrible year a year ago, but he's also a guy that's shown in the past that he can really be an ace-type pitcher. Is he the kind of guy that the Orioles really look for as a guy they can get in their system and get turned around?
I think so. I think, honestly, he would be a good fit. He's a guy who was probably looking at maybe a $100 million deal up until the year he had, like you mentioned. So he would be a good fit when you look at what the Orioles have been able to do under pitching coach Dave Wallace, some of the individual improvements they've been able to make. I feel like he would be a good fit, provided he doesn't, you know, price himself out of what the Orioles are looking to spend. Obviously, trades are another option, and a much wider net can be cast with trades in terms of what teams are able to give up. But I still think that when you look at the free agent market and you look at this pitching class, this is a good group, and it probably won't be this deep again for quite some time.
The Orioles' bullpen has gotten a lot of work over the last couple of years, so how important is it that whoever they bring into that rotation is a guy who can really give the team innings?
It would be huge. You know, they really don't have a veteran starter. They haven't really in those past two or three years. So I think getting a guy who can eat innings, like you mentioned, takes some pressure off of that bullpen and really just kind of stops some of the losing streaks and some of the long stretches they had this year, you know, 10, 11 games, where they didn't have a quality start. They need a guy that they can depend on to at least go six or seven innings and put a stop to some of the unfortunate things that happened during this past season where they couldn't find a way to right the ship and go deep into those games. And it just had a ripple effect. I think they're really looking to find a way to stabilize that rotation.
All right, now let's talk about Matt Wieters. He obviously accepts the qualifying offer. I think that was a surprise. Before this season, obviously no players had ever accepted a qualifying offer. How does that affect this team? Because obviously, on one hand, the Orioles have to be excited to have Wieters back in their lineup, but it's also nearly $16 million that I don't think they expected to be on the books.
Exactly. I think they like having him back, his leadership, the way he works with that pitching staff. But this is the most money they've ever doled out on a one-year deal. So they can't be too thrilled about financially how much it could handicap them moving forward, because now, when you look at that payroll, in terms of money allowed and possible raises and arbitration, you're looking at about $92 million without any additions. Now, you have to fill out that major league team with at least guys who are making league minimum salary. So if you're going to go out and you're going to get some of the pitchers we discussed and you're going to make a play at Chris Davis, it's going to take a big jump in payroll to make that happen.
And now, since that has happened, Dan Duquette is on the record as saying he still thinks that the team has the resources to get that pitcher and make a run at Chris Davis. But then last week, there was the comment that his conversation with Scott Boris about Davis was the, quote, shortest and quickest negotiation he's had with Boris. So, realistically, are the Orioles in play for Chris Davis in your mind?
Realistically, I think they're in play. I think ownership really wants to bring Chris Davis back. I just don't see a scenario where they're not outbid somewhere along the way. I mean, he's a marquee free agent with power. He's a guy who's going to command a ton of money on a free agent market. And for the Orioles, they had Chris Davis this year. He performed very well. They still didn't make the postseason. I think at the end of the day, you have to look at what he's able to do and what he's not able to do and realize that putting that money into another starting pitcher might help Baltimore, might be better served and allocating all of this team's resources to bringing back Chris Davis.
In other words, seeing the bigger plan and the bigger weakness on this team. So if Davis does depart, obviously that's a lot of home runs, a lot of production that the team has to in some way replace. So where do you think they would look if Davis ends up elsewhere?
I think they're going to have to rely on some of the natural maturation of guys like Jonathan Scope, who missed a lot of his past season with an injury, Manny Machado, another guy who came into his own this year. And they're going to have to rely on a better year from Adam Jones and Matt Wieters. So there's ways to do it. There's ways around what Chris Davis is able to do. Because keep in mind, there are stretches where Chris Davis really struggles and he just becomes a high strikeout guy in the lineup. So there are ways around it. And also, if they pitch better, just allowing less runs is going to take a lot of pressure off of that offense overall.
This has been MLB.com Extras Look Inside the American League East. Tune in again next time.